If you ask me, was this overactive imagination? No. I know what I saw, but I'm not saying to you that I know what it was, but I can tell you that this most definitely was not a vampire.
Hello there, I'm Hayley Stevens, and this is The Spooktator, a podcast which examines the stranger elements of life, society, international culture, and the media. I'm joined by Charlie Revel-Smith and Paul Gannon.
Hello everyone.
I do not exist.
We know. In this episode, we'll be discussing the death of Lorraine Warren, satanic panics, and the Highgate Vampire. First, though, let's take a look at some listener feedback.
It's nice to have some listener feedback, isn't it?
It certainly
is. I know, yes. I feel like I've been slightly neglectful on this front because I've seen it in the inboxes on Twitter and on our email account, and I haven't necessarily responded. And it's not because I don't care, it's just I'm just really badly organised as a person. So
basically, rude. You're just rude, yeah, is what it is. Lazy and rude.
But not maliciously so, just...
Okay. Is it really nice to get emails about, you know, things like ghosts and messages about people's experiences? Because I'm just used to getting emails about where people have found dog dirt.
Are you?
Yes.
Why
because
would you
of,
be getting...
Because of Cheap Show. We have a whole segment, and that whole segment involves people saying, look what disgusting thing I found at Domino's Pizza. And then I go, oh, I'm not eating Domino's Pizza again.
Oh, God. No.
Yeah, that's the lovely difference when I do this podcast as opposed to the other one, because this one's kind of nice.
Yeah.
And Cheap Show's a grubby, dirty little schoolboy who gets his hand smacked every day.
Well, I was, this first piece of feedback, which we'll go into in just a second, I was actually telling my colleague about this today at work, just you know, because she's interested in weird stuff, but not to the level that we are.
Okay.
And so I started just telling her about it, and I looked up at one point and she's just staring at me like, what the actual... I don't know if you remember a few episodes ago, I think it was season 4, episode 1, we casually suggested that there must be such a thing as a frogman out there. We were talking about the sort of cryptids that we would like to see making the news in 2019, and we just kind of casually mentioned the frogman and how it must be a thing. Sometimes it's interesting to see what people start talking about around this time that might continue to be the hot topics as the year carries on. If you're listening to this and something comes to mind, maybe you've seen people talking about, I don't know, the frogman. I suspect there is actually a frogman out there. I was just trying to think of one off the top of my head, but let's face it, there probably is a frogman. We'd love
his name's Michael Gove, am I right? Now, this isn't like Scooby-Doo Frogman, where it's a man in an old diving suit.
Well, jury's kind of out on that.
Okay.
One. Okay,
I'm just
I
wondering
guess.
What kind of frogman to imagine in my head right now as we go forward.
Well, think of a frog, think of a man,
right,
and then sort of merge them together.
So it looks like that Sonic the Hedgehog movie, basically.
I'm kind of thinking more like Toad of Toad Hall in my head.
Oh.
In my head, that kind of a nice tweed jacket and things.
Well, that's Nigel Farage, but
oh,
imagine...
getting political, blimey.
So the author of Spooky Archaeology, Jeb Card, is a listener of the show, and he got in touch after listening to season 4, episode 1, to say that there is a frogman. Such a creature has been sighted, which blew my tiny mind. And so he gave some information, and I had a quick look into it as well. But in Ohio folklore, there's such a thing as the Loveland Frogman, which is also known as the Loveland Lizard. And it's a humanoid frog described as standing at roughly 4 feet tall. And it's been spotted on several occasions over the decades in Loveland in Ohio. And the original stories involve a businessman or a travelling salesman. It tends to really differ depending on which retelling you listen to. And this guy is driving along an unnamed road late at night in the dark. And in one version, the driver's heading out of the Branch Hill neighbourhood in Ohio when he spotted three figures stood erect on their hind legs along the side of the road, each standing at roughly 3 to 4 feet in height, with leathery skin and frog faces. Now, I just love the frog faces bit.
Just casually tapped on the end.
Yeah, why just, not?
You know, they, yes. Oh, yeah, they had frog faces. In the other versions of the story, the creatures were spotted under or over a poorly lit bridge. And the guy watches the figures converse for a while until one of the creatures held a wand over its head and fired a spray of sparks, which startled the guy watching them, who then fled from the scene. As you would, wouldn't you?
No, I'd have questions.
Really?
I just love these bits. Local folklore things can be just so strange. Like the yeah. little details in it are just so weird, more so than you would, you know, than you generally find in like the bigger, you know, the more well-known cryptozoology stories. The really kind of like lesser known ones are like, what on earth is this?
Or maybe it's a very close-knit family with firecrackers.
Who just happen to look like frogs.
Yes. It's Ohio. Why not?
Oh, that's...
Sorry to everyone listening in Ohio.
Yeah. Dis. Now, further to this, on the 3rd of March, 1972, at 1 a.m, Loveland police officer Ray Shockey was driving on Riverside Drive near the Totes Boot Factory. I don't know why I've added that in, like we know. Oh, yeah, the boot factory.
Oh, yeah, the Totes Boot Factory, of course.
Where all the frogmen hang out.
When an unidentified animal scurried across the road in front of his vehicle. The animal was fully illuminated in his headlights, and he described it as 3 to 4 feet long and weighing about 50 to 75 pounds with leathery skin. He reported spotting the animal crouched like a frog before it momentarily stood erect to climb over the guardrail and back down towards the river.
You'd think it'd jump.
Well, yeah, maybe it's just a tired frog. 2 weeks after, I mean, you don't know, at that height and that weight, that might be quite a fat frogman and jumping might be out of the question.
Well, then there's not much point of him being a frogman then, is there?
Well, yeah.
Does he have a long tongue?
I don't know.
I have many questions.
Yeah, me too, to be honest. 2 weeks, 2 weeks after the incident, a second Loveland police officer, Mark Matthews, reported seeing an unidentified animal crouched along the road in the same area as Shockey's sighting. Matthews shot the animal, because this is America. He recovered the body and put it in his trunk to show Officer Shockey. According to Matthews, it was a large iguana, about 3 or 3.5 feet long, and he didn't immediately recognise it because it was missing its tail. Matthews speculated that the iguana had been someone's pet that either got loose or was released when it grew too large. According to Matthews, Shockey was shown the dead iguana and confirmed it was the animal he had seen 2 weeks previously. Matthews recounted the incident to an author of a book about urban legends, but says the author omitted that part that confirmed the creature was an iguana rather than a frogman.
The man from iguana.
He shot the iguana. Like, don't do that.
So we've kind of got an explanation for behind this story then.
For this one at least.
Was he doing a stand his ground thing? Do you reckon that's what it was?
Maybe.
Like he thought he was in imminent danger.
What, the iguana was?
Yeah, no, the guy shot the iguana. He was like, you know, oh, it's coming right for us, that kind of thing.
I like that the iguana might have been too. And he was like, drop your weapon, and then it wouldn't.
Yeah,
they don't include that detail. But
so
you know.
is out of interest, going off on a slight tangent, people seeing frogmen out and about, isn't that kind of similar to like what Hellier is about as well? Ooh, to some extent?
It's so weird that you say that. Oh, that's spooky. Okay, stick with me here.
Oh, all right, I'll stick.
There have also been other reports of experiences with creatures said to be the frogman further out from Loveland, Ohio, such as a group of women who went swimming in the Ohio River, roughly 250 miles away from Loveland. One of the women claims that something grabbed her and pulled her under the water and that it had large claws and a furry palm. We all know why. When the grip loosened, she made it back to the beach and treated her scratched and bruised leg. According to the Skeptoid episode about this, when the eyewitness heard about the Sutton family's 1955 battle with supposed spacemen in nearby western Kentucky, more infamously known as the Kelly Hopkinsville Goblins, she felt that the events must have been connected and remembered they also saw a flying saucer around the same time as the incident in the river, which begs the question Does the frogman hop down to Hellier? How strange that you pointed that Hellier, though, and I literally made the same point in my pre-prepared notes.
Well, it's because we're educated individuals, aren't we?
Yes.
And we make logical connections.
Yes. We are so smart.
Yeah, that's it. I just thought it was similar because, you know, like UFO abductions are very similar in how they're described as to when fairies would abduct people and the same kind of things were seen. Yeah. And even though they're two very different things, fairies and aliens, I was thinking maybe this frogman thing is just similar to the people seeing the little troll monsters scattling about. So maybe, maybe they're aliens.
And in the 1955 Kelly Hopkinsville goblin case, they thought that what they were dealing with were spacemen, and they infamously they battled with them. They defended the cabin and shot at the creatures. Whereas in Hellier, that didn't happen. The whole story around that is less established. But the belief is that they are connected in some way. And some people even suggest that those phenomena are what's called crypto-terrestrial. It sounds complicated, but I think it's just a made-up word, really.
Yeah. I didn't get to see all of that, but I did read the article that you wrote, and it was very interesting.
Oh, thank you. I think Hellier is definitely worth watching if you have the time. You know, I do think it's too long. They spend too long doing things that
it's passed out,
they drag it out a bit, like Most Haunted does, you know, in their episodes and so on.
It's funny though, because this feels like a kind of good intentions kind of film, you know, where it's like they've gone out there with their happy little investigator hats on and gone on a little adventure, but at the same time, the things you pointed out are quite important to the veracity of what they're doing.
Yeah, exactly. Like making sure that your eyewitness is actually a real person
and have eyes just on the off chance.
Yeah. At least one.
It's all you need.
I don't know why I said that. In episode 2 of season 4, we discussed the story of La Llorona in the lead up to the release of a horror movie about that particular paranormal legend. A listener by the name of Fox wrote in following this and said, quote, "I just wanted to add in a few things to your discussion of La Llorona. I haven't, by the way," this is not quoted, this is unquote. "This email had a lot of words in it that I had to look up the pronunciation for, and I'm still not 100% sure, so I'm not even sorry."
So I wasn't in the last episode, so this is the story about the legend that the new film has been based on, about the woman ghost who steals kids.
Lures people away by crying.
I'm generalising to a massive extent, but
it's good to know you listen to the podcast, Paul.
Of course I do.
Right, quote, "I haven't read Ben Radford's piece, but the ties to German folklore are very interesting because there was substantial German immigration into Texas during the 1830s to 1840s. It may be that the seed of the La Llorona story came from the contact between German settlers and Mexican and Tejano residents, just as with the accordion, which is an integral part of the conjunto music." He adds, "There's also a creek near Seguin, Texas, called Woman Hollering Creek, named after La Llorona. Seguin and the creek are firmly in the sway of German and Polish settlements in Texas, just a stone's throw away, by Texas standards, from New Braunfels. Sadly, there is no sign on the highway to mark the creek. I've looked. Just wanted to share that. I thought you might find it interesting. I get very excited every time I see a new episode. Your show is one of my favourites. Cheers. Thank you, Fox," who is totally...
Yeah, thanks, Fox.
As soon as I saw that we had an email from someone called Fox, I was like, Fox Mulder.
Oh, I thought you meant Basil Brush.
Oh.
Maybe it's Basil Brush listens to the show. That'd be wicked. Did he sign off with Bum Bum?
No.
Nah, then it's not.
Lorraine Warren has died, aged 92. She's probably known to pretty much everybody who is listening as being one half of the Warrens, with her husband, Ed Warren. He died in 2006, but apparently was still guiding her and her various investigations from beyond the grave right up to her death on April 18th of this month, or last month when this episode comes out. they were probably about as famous as they were notorious. And several sources that I found online were claiming that they were the most famous paranormal researchers in history, which I think is... I think it's probably pushing it. I would always, depending on how sceptical you're going to go, I would always go either Harry Price or Houdini, depending on on how loose you want with your investigators.
If you speak to the person on the street and you say, have you heard of Harry Price? They'll probably say no, but thanks to the Conjuring movies and Annabelle and The Nun, there's more chance that, yeah, thanks to all of that, people might know what the Warrens are.
Yeah, it's probably true. Yeah,
but I think, though, when it comes to Harry Price, if you mention to someone Bawley Rectory, they might not have heard of Harry Price, but they probably will have heard of Bawley. Hmm.
To be honest, if you ask people in the street to name a paranormal investigator, they would probably come up with Yvette Fielding before anybody else in this country.
She's not the worst, though. So,
or Peter Venkman, the Ghostbusters. People might just say that as well. They're only touchstones.
Yeah, there's always that as well.
Yeah.
Well, anyway, Ed Warren claimed to be a demonologist, while Lorraine claimed to be a clairvoyant and a trance medium. But she also mixed lots of evangelical ideas in with her ideas as well.
Can I just say that when people say trance mediumship, I always just think they mean like trance music.
I think that too. Yeah, I agree.
Like conjuring the dead using trance music. Yes. Now, the pair of them met probably sometime in the late 40s, early 50s, and they founded the New England Society for Psychic Research in 1952. Now, the pair of them claimed to both be based in science, but throughout their entire careers, right up to her death, essentially, there were claims that they didn't understand what the scientific method was and that all of their claims about the paranormal were highly dubious and possibly even fraudulent. Now, they came to fame largely during the 1970s. Now, the 70s was like a really, really interesting time as far as pop culture was concerned. And I hadn't really thought about this until quite recently, about just how much a lot of things changed in Western culture during that period. I always get a little bit worn out with people banging on about the 1960s and about how awesome they were and how everything changed for that generation, because they're almost always straight men and the rest of us didn't really get a chance or a say in anything until the 70s came along and you started seeing more of a feminist movement, more of a gay rights movement started getting its foothold in Britain and America. And the counterculture movement of the 70s meant that a lot of people were questioning kind of traditional religious and spiritual beliefs and started looking for alternatives. Now, during this period, alternative beliefs kind of entered the mainstream in a way that hadn't been seen since kind of the aftermath of the First World War, when there was a big interest in spiritualism, you know, with so many people having lost loved ones in that war. Now, it was this period that Uri Geller and Doris Stokes became regulars on the talk show circuit around the world. There was police officers who were openly admitting to using psychic investigators in especially serial crimes. There were worldwide movements like World Contact Day, where people around the world were trying to telepathically communicate with aliens. And none of this was particularly outside of the norm at the time. Obviously, at this time, there was the supposed hauntings of Amityville and also Enfield in London. And these were front page news. There was documentaries that went out in prime time about these hauntings. And it was during this period that obviously the Warrens rose to real prominence.
I was going to say, was it off the back of the Amityville case or was there something in particular that put them front and centre in terms of the media?
I think that it was the Amityville Horror which really made their name, and obviously the book which came out of it, and it is the Amityville Horror was and is what they're still most closely associated with.
Are they in the film as characters, the Warrens?
I don't think they are. And I think that there was weird kind of legal things, I know, especially concerning the most recent version of the 2005 adaptation of the book. And I think this is because the Warrens are kind of they weren't allowed to tell certain stories. They'd handed over rights to production companies and things like that. But this was a 1976 case of a supposed haunting of a family home in New York. And it became the subject of a book, The Amityville Horror, which was then made into a film in 1979, which was remade, as I said, in 2005. Now, I couldn't believe this. This film series now consists of 23 films, 14 of which have been made since 2011.
That's crazy.
Astonishingly, yes. It's generally believed to have been a hoax, and that the Warrens, along with the Lutz family who owned the house, concocted this story for money. At the very least, people claim that the Warrens greatly exaggerated their role, what happened in the Amityville haunting, and also exaggerated the role in other hauntings. The Conjuring 2 would have it be known that the Warrens are right at the very centre of this Enfield haunting, Poltergeist haunting, and there are claims that they never even managed to get a foot in the door. They did come over to visit, but the family weren't interested. They already had their own investigators working on it.
I think it's fair to say that the Warrens, from all of my reading of their research, they were very much the sort of people who inserted themselves into the stories.
Oh yeah, they were terrific at self-publicity.
Yeah, some of the cases they were involved with, they were asked to become involved with, but with Amityville and with others, they just sort of showed up. They were just like, we're going to get involved in this. The same with Enfield, where I think investigators from the Society for Psychical Research essentially turned them away.
When The Conjuring 2 came out, there was a terrific video clip showing like supposed the sisters in the Enfield Poltergeist case being reunited with Lorraine Warren. And it was so clear from everybody's body language that these people had never met before. And you can basically see the two, the two now women from the Enfield Poltergeist case pretty much looking at the camera and saying, can we have our money now? Because they had...
There's so much exploitation going on in that second film, because what they obviously had to do was... they couldn't do certain Warren cases because of legal proceedings. They knew that in some notes they'd said, oh, we went to England once and saw the Enfield Poltergeist. They developed the Enfield Poltergeist as a film and inserted them into it. So from a Hollywood point of view, I don't feel too harsh on the Warrens themselves, because that was like a creative, artistic and, you know, a marketing thing to get them into that sequel. But the upside of it is that when you have like them being drawn into the marketing for the film and the sisters being asked to support it, it all just gets very, very creepy. It all gets very like exploitative across all sides to sell what is effectually, just a basic kind of haunted house movie. There's not much to it other than that.
There almost didn't need to be any basis in reality at all. With it, especially as earlier that year, there had been a Sky One adaptation of This House is Haunted, which was a lot closer to, for want of a better word, the facts of the case, and was generally just a lot better made as well. So
that enjoyed that.
Timothy Spall?
Terrific, yes.
Rafe Spall.
Yeah.
Rafe Spall, yes.
No, it was definitely a Spall.
You're right, it's Timothy Spall, and I'm thinking of Rafe Spall, who played Harry Price.
Oh, that's
yes,
right.
Yeah, that's exactly what I'm thinking as well. Yeah, you're right, yes. there was a cracking adaptation and genuinely scary.
Yeah.
And also interesting, because it focused on, I've forgotten his name now, the lead investigator, brain's gone blank.
Maurice Gross and Skyline Playfair.
I liked that, you know, because it looked at the... like his tragic kind of backstory and how the case kind of rang true.
Yes, and how he, because he had a daughter who died who just happened to be called Janet, and that he was still grieving for her, and that's why he actually formed this this very close paternal bond with Janet, the younger of the two sisters. And that was a really interesting, dramatic story. Much better than any of that kind of crap they have with the nun showing up in The Conjuring 2.
Again, which just builds the universe so they can make a nun movie
so they
later
can have,
on down the line.
Yes.
Yeah. And three Ouija movies or whatever it was, and two Annabelles, or three Annabelles.
There's
I can't
a
remember
third
how many
one is coming up this summer.
Bloody hell.
Yeah.
Can I just say at this point, did anyone watch I think it was The Warren's Son when they did this kind of ritual where they had to change Annabelle from one cage to another because the box they kept her in was getting old, so they removed it. Did you watch it? It was like a live Facebook thing.
No, I didn't know.
No, I knew that it was being broadcast, but I didn't watch it.
It was so up itself. There was this weird sense of like a religious service going on where like prayers were read and things had to be very specifically done, and it was all very, you know, like when you see an old kind of movie about a cult and everyone wears cloaks and it's all like yum 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 yum, and it has that sense of cult-like think when they're doing it, and I found it so fascinating to watch.
Well, that's one of the trademarks of the Warrens, and always was, that when they became involved in a case, to them it was sort of like a religious crusade, in that whatever the case was, it was demons or Satanism and the devil that were causing the activity, and that exorcism.
That was another thing which I really disliked about The Conjuring 2 as well, is that they had layered on this sort of evangelical stuff onto what is generally thought of as a kind of secular haunting, really. No one ever was really talking about "In This House Is Haunted" about calling a priest in or things like that. It just wasn't part of that narrative because we don't have that kind of evangelical movement of any significance in this country.
Well, I mean, people who do have or believe that the houses are haunted, there are aspects of the church that will become involved, but it is at their request.
It didn't happen in this case, in the case of the Enfield Poltergeist, I don't think, anyway.
No, it certainly doesn't ring any bells in my head about anything like that.
Off the top of my head.
But it certainly wasn't the focus of the investigation. That's the probably better distinction to make.
Yeah. Now, the original Conjuring film recreates a talk show encounter between, I think it was Joe Nichol and Ed Warren. But as with so much of the Conjuring films, it kind of repaints everybody. It repaints the Warrens to be much more agreeable and likeable, but perhaps a little bit short-tempered. But you can actually see the original clip online, and it's a lot more confrontational, and it's actually really quite difficult to watch. I found it. I didn't think it was. But many people who did encounter Ed especially had a few kind words to say for him, saying that he was rude and aggressive and potentially even knowingly fraudulent, and obviously hiding behind this kind of air of aggression so people would feel less comfortable confronting him over it. Now, he died in 2006, but Lorraine continued her work for the New England Society for Psychic Research, as well as maintaining their museum of haunted and curious objects in the basement of their home, which includes the notorious Raggedy Ann doll, Annabelle. And as I said, who is about to become the subject of a third film, which I just find astonishing. But
Killer Dolls are on the way back. They've got a new challenge play coming out.
Oh, yeah, there's a new Chucky one, isn't there?
There's two new Chuckys
coming
out.
Oh, is there? Really?
One's the movie, which has Mark Hamill voicing the new Chucky, and it's got nothing to do with voodoo. It's just like evil AI. And the second one is a TV series spinning off from where the films ended. So it's got all the original Child's Play cast.
Oh, right, okay.
Creative crew involved. So, yeah, weird.
Yeah. Okay, well, whatever you think about the Warrens and psychic research or paranormal research, for many people, this is the end of an era, at least as far as dubious paranormal research goes on. But I think it's fair to say that somebody else will come along and will take their place. And along with that as well, as Lorraine is no longer around, trying to manage the reputation of the Warrens, I think, unfortunately, we're also going to see even more and even crappier movies about their lives and supposed investigations in the future. So that is the Warrens, who are now no longer with us. Or are they?
This is the thing. This is my theory. I believe we're going to get a movie that will have all the dead ghost hunters meet up in the afterlife and become ghosts that hunt humans. And so there'll be the Warrens, Price, there'll be, let's throw in Zach Bagels or whatever his name is, because why not? Who else?
He's not dead.
Plot point.
Well, you got Houdini in there.
Houdini?
Why would Houdini join up with them?
Well, not only because now that Houdini is a ghost, he realizes that he was completely wrong.
Yeah, but even so, he would still know that, you know, he would have principles.
Well, that's where you get your dramatic conflict from the Warrens and him. That's what they work together to defeat the big bad guy in the end.
Who's the big bad guy?
Jesus. I don't know. I got put on the spot and panicked. But I don't know. That's my the Avengers of ghost hunters. That's my logic. Hollywood, call me.
How familiar are you guys with the Highgate Vampire?
I know enough to be fascinated by it, but I don't know all the gory details.
Yeah, I know of references to it, but it's never been one of those cases which I've really looked into myself. It's more like one of those things that I know it more through people who I know who are interested in it, but I would not be able to go behind like the mere outline of what happened, so certainly not an expert on it.
Okay, well, in early April 2019, it was announced that David Farrant had passed away, and those who hold an interest in the paranormal, such as yourselves, often do know about the Highgate Vampire, but don't know all the details, because it's one of those stories that has a lot of information and a lot of misinformation that surrounds it. And David Farrant, who was the president of the British Psychic and Occult Society, was involved in the Highgate Vampire saga. Now, back in 2009, I was the co-host of a podcast called Righteous Indignation, and along with my co-hosts at the time, Michael Marshall and Tristan Swell, interviewed David Farrant about this. And with the news of his passing, I thought it seemed fit to share once again the interview with David, in which he was able to put his side of the story across. So this is the interview that we conducted in 2009 with the late David Farrant.
Joined by David Farrant, President of the British Psychic and Occult Society, although he's probably best known in British folklore as one of the central characters in the now legendary Highgate Vampire investigations of the late 60s and early 1970s. His autobiography, In the Shadow of the Highgate Vampire, is currently available through Amazon. Hi David, thanks for joining us.
Oh, good evening, thank you for inviting me.
That's no problem. First of all, if you could just fill us in with some background on yourself, how you became involved in paranormal investigations.
To answer you simply at this stage, I really think it was down to my mother's influence. Now, my mother was involved in the spiritualist church. When I was 13, my mother died, and that had a tremendous impact on me. I felt as though somehow I'd lost part of my life. My father had sent me away to school, and I actually ran away from school twice because I just wanted to get home again. And he sent me back again because he was determined that I get a good education and I learn material things as opposed to having this interest in spiritual side of life. I really started being a psychic investigator when I left school. I ended up meeting a lady who was herself actually a high priestess in Wicca.
Could you give us some background on the Wiccan religion?
Can I just tell you what Wicca is not? Well, there's been so much confusion by certain people in particular, and you keep asserting that Wicca is to do with black magic and Satanism. Mm-hmm. Now, Wicca, in its true sense, has nothing whatsoever to do with those two dangerous practices, because we believe that there was an infinite principle.
Mm-hmm. If it's okay to ask, if you could expand on what the infinite principle actually is.
The only difference in Wicca is that they still have acknowledge a male deity, which is symbolized by the solar principle, which is obviously the sun. Mm. But a big main difference is that they also accept the existence of a goddess. That's the main difference between Wicca and most conventional religions.
I think it's interesting you describe Satanism as a dangerous form of worship. Can I just clarify what you mean by dangerous? I mean, obviously, many people don't believe in a personal Satan because they don't believe in necessarily a personal God, and you don't necessarily believe that there is any power attached to Satanism, that it's a kooky belief system. What do you think is the danger?
Yes, it is dangerous, because if you focus or concentrate that human mind for an evil purpose, it can rebound on you. I mean, you've heard of all these cases of so-called possession. That's when people really believe they're possessed by demonic spirits. I don't believe that is the case at all. I believe that they do become possessed, but they become possessed by powers, negative powers, overwhelming negative powers that exist in human mind. If you develop the human mind to worship evil, self-gain, or to get your own way, or to harm people, obviously that effect is going to reverse on you.
Sure, I know you mentioned that you believe Satanists, you know, they worship the devil in order to get material possessions and success and all the kind of things that happen in this kind of world. What is the reason why for Wicca practitioners worshipping their own infinite principles? I mean, do you believe that that your own lives can be influenced by the worship you give to the infinite principle in a materialistic way or in a real kind of lifestyle kind of way?
Yes, I do. Yes.
Alongside your Wicca practice, you say that you founded the British Occult Society, although another ex-member, Mr. Sean Manchester, says that he was the originator. Could you outline your version of the history of the organisation and explain what it aimed to achieve?
I was involved with a group of people, if you like, psychic investigators, back in 1966. And we had a small society going. It didn't have a name at that stage. But in 1967... I decided to get all these people together with all their interests, and by now the society was getting bigger, and I called it the British Occult Society. It was nothing to do with any other person, although certain people tried to steal our name and started causing us a lot of trouble. All I'll say to that is in 1983, I actually changed the name of the British Occult Society to the British Psychic and Occult Society. So many people were making trouble for the society, to newspapers and in other directions.
Okay, if we can move on to the Highgate saga itself, can you outline how you became involved in what is now one of the most infamous and notorious paranormal investigations of the 20th century? Or maybe better still, could you tell us your entire side of events?
I do not believe in the existence of vampires. In the late 60s, there were reports in and around Highgate Cemetery in North London of a tall, dark figure that had been sighted mainly by the top gate, but also inside the cemetery and in Swains Lane, which runs outside. In those days, Highgate Cemetery was open to the public, but only during, obviously, daylight hours. It was locked at night, but having said that, the back gate was always fully open. It was very, very easy to climb over the dilapidated fences. So technically, it was open to the public. Open to the public at night, that people were always going in there, vandals causing damage, breaking open coffins, you name it, they did it. People actually on an organised scale going in there and breaking into the old Victorian vault, smashing open coffins, and actually, on some occasions, putting stakes through corpses. And what happened was that reports of this entity, this happened, I interviewed quite a few people at that time, local residents, local witnesses, and stress it had been witnessed by quite a few different people, completely unknown to each other. The story of this ghost began to get into the local press, and it caught the attention of certain other people. We tried to turn this relatively harmless, earthbound figure into a vampire. In fact, one of these people actually went onto the television when they first filmed it. They were interviewing myself, and he pulled a cross out from under his jacket and a wooden stake from out of the back of his trousers. And he said to Sandra Harris, she asked him, she said, "Now, why do you think it's a vampire?" And he said, "Because my society member," he hadn't even got a society, "members have been investigating it." And he said to Sandra Harris, "The only way to destroy a vampire is to stake it through the heart with one blow, chop off its head with a grave digger's shovel." This is what he said on the television. "And burn what remains. Now, Tristan, going back to this ghost, before people cashed in on its appearances and tried to turn it into a vampire, I actually saw something at Highgate Cemetery myself, which really started my interest in it. It was late 1969, just before Christmas, a very cold night. And I went to Highgate Cemetery because I heard about all these reports. And I was hoping to find some logical explanation for it. For example, I thought it might be the wind causing a tree branch to move, which was casting a shadow in the lane outside, possibly that it could have been foxes, because there were foxes breeding in Highgate Cemetery, and they still are to this day. As I was passing the main gate, very quickly I caught sight of a tall, dark figure. Now, it must have been nearly as tall as the gate, which would have been about 7 or 8 feet tall, the gate. I couldn't see the actual bottom of it, because it all disappeared into impenetrable blackness, but it seemed it could have been floating off the ground. My very first reaction, I thought, somebody has been reading the local press, heard these reports about a possible vampire, and dressed up, waiting to frighten people, the odd person behind the gates that pass the cemetery. That's my very split-second reaction. But I soon realised that it was not that at all. The area turned ice cold, and it was a very cold night anyway.
I mean, obviously, you're of the opinion that it was a ghost that was responsible. Could it have been no more than maybe misattribution of shadows on your behalf? Or, you know, could it be heightened anxiety because you're in a dark graveyard?
If you're asking me, was this overactive imagination? No. I know what I saw, but I'm not saying to you that I know what it was. But I can tell you that this most definitely was not a vampire.
So you saw something that at the time you weren't able to explain?
That's right, yeah. Okay. And also saw something that had been witnessed by quite a few other local people.
From there, the whole affair seemed to rumble out of control. And there's legends of you being involved in a wizard's duel with Sean Manchester at a later date. And there's also a story, which I've heard being circulated, that Sean chased the alleged vampire or ghost into a mansion which you occupied and staked it.
He claimed, well, in his version, with a group of other unnamed people, he claimed to have tracked the vampire down to a tomb in Highgate Cemetery. They'd been led there by a sleepwalking girl he named Lucia. He admits that they barged in the door, they broke the door open, and he forced the lid off the coffin. He says from memory, and lying in the coffin, and there's a vivid description of this, his eyes glazed, his mouth still terribly gorged with blood from its rampages the night previously. And no, this is absolutely what he said, and I'm not exaggerating what he said.
I know you're not exaggerating, it's just completely bizarre.
But please remember, he said it. I'm summarising it. He raised his arm to stake it to his heart, and one of his assistants grabbed his arm and said, "No, you can't do that. That would be sacrilege." Now, that's a laugh, isn't it? And so Manchester claims that he performed an exorcism instead.
So if we could move on to look at some of the claims Sean's actually made about you, if that's okay. We actually gave him the chance to come on an episode of the podcast in the future, but he's actually declined. And he said, "It's been my policy since my very first transmission on this topic to never share a platform with Farrant. If I become aware that an interviewer or project intends to include this charlatan, they lose all hope of my contribution." So if our listeners are unaware, there seems to have been something of an extended debate between yourself, David, and Sean that has dragged on for more than 20 years as to what actually happened at Highgate, as we've already explored. First of all, Farrant's vampire hunting was no more than a stunt. He consented to providing tape-recorded interviews, photographic records and film reconstructions of his alleged vampire hunting, which is nothing more than a pathetic means to gain self-publicity. We are mindful of the interview he gave the BBC 24 Hours television team, transmitted in October 1970. Farrant was invited to make a contribution because of what he was doing in August 1970, when police discovered him prowling about in Highgate Cemetery with a crudely made cross and stake. The programme itself was titled Vampires, and when asked about his vampire hunting, Farrant went along with the notion he'd given to all and sundry that he was in a graveyard to try and impale the Highgate vampire. I mean, obviously, as you've already stated, that you don't believe in vampires in the Hollywood sense of the word. And if that's the case, why did you appear in these images and reports with a cross and a stake?
In 1970, I was actually arrested in Highgate Cemetery with some other people. We'd gone in there to conduct the seance. Two of them had cars parked outside the main gate. The idea was to try and make communication. We had a psychic medium with us to see what it really was. We began making preparations for the ceremony inside the cemetery, quite near the back wall. And after not so many minutes, we saw flashlights in the distance and we heard loud voices, and it was quite obvious to us it was the police. Obviously not wishing to be caught with the sort of witchcraft, occult paraphernalia, because we felt the police wouldn't understand. I happen to know someone that lived in a house in South Grove, which backs onto Highgate Cemetery itself, rather its garden did. So I decided to sort of veer off to my right. I had other implements with me. I didn't have a cross and a stake. All members wore small Celtic crosses. There was a stake, but the purpose of that was to make it had magical symbols engraved on it, and it was attached to a small piece of, well, a longish piece of white cord. The purpose of the stake was to obviously stick it into the ground and cast a magical circle for protection.
You've explained your side of the story in regard to the stake, but I can recall looking at a photo where you seem to be holding the stake above your head like you're about to strike with it and stab something.
When the case came to court, all the police produced in evidence was this stake minus the string and the small cross. I pleaded guilty, and I remember there were press in the court. Police read out a statement attributed to myself, basically that I intended to search through the coffins, and when I came across the vampire, I intended to stake through the heart with my wooden stake and then run away. But the point is, I never made that statement. But the fact it was read out in open court, well, people heard it, and I became branded as a vampire hunter. That's how I first got this label of vampire, being a vampire hunter, when I'm not at all. I'm just a psychic investigator. All that happened was I was approached after the court case, after I'd been acquitted, remember, and I was asked, it was by the BBC, yes, it was the BBC 24 Hours programme. They asked me to bring a cross and a stake to be filmed with it in Highgate Cemetery, and they got permission to film me. Yes, I did do that, and there is film footage of me actually holding the cross and the stake and wearing the rosary, so-called hunting the vampire.
With your statement that you don't believe in vampires, which I'm sure is probably true, was that not a slightly unusual move?
No, it's not really, because look, I hadn't turned all this stuff into a vampire. It was the press and certain other people that had been doing that. Christopher Lee plays Dracula.
Okay.
It doesn't mean to say he's a real vampire, does he? He's just an actor.
In retrospect, do you feel if you were trying to move away from the label of being a vampire hunter, which you said earlier, kind of annoys you a little bit that you get this label?
Well, of course.
In retrospect, do you regret the decision to make, to take the photographs and the footage with the stake and give people the idea that you do hunt vampires?
I think especially how Sean's tried to use it against you as well.
Yeah, well, that's why I regret it. You know, we all do things in the past which we later regret in later life.
I was just a bit confused going back to your sighting, because you mentioned that you weren't sure what it was you were seeing, but you knew that it was a ghost. And I'm just wondering how you were able to make that like leap of logic, and how you were able to decide that it was a ghost and what it was about your sighting that made you so sure.
Well, by the use of my senses. I know what I saw. I was using the senses of my eyes. It didn't make any sound, admittedly. And the fact it just disappeared in front of of my eyes after it had appeared, I didn't really have any other choice but to term it supernatural. Can I just tell you, Hayley, look, I'm not a psychic, yeah? You know, often we look for a logical explanation. We find one. Often we spend nights in people's houses, obviously with permission, or haunted locations, and nothing happens. So we just say it, put it on the record. Nothing sighted, nothing heard, nothing recorded. But when things do happen, we do record them. I mean, I haven't even got time to go into all the other investigations. I wouldn't even attempt it. But I do know what I saw at that top gate. And I do know, as I said, repeat again, Hayley, it was definitely not a vampire, but it was just unexplainable.
Have you heard The Dollop recently? There was an episode a few weeks ago called America's First Ghost.
Oh, no.
It's brilliant. It's about America's first documented ghost, and it's this fascinating story that doesn't have a satisfying ending, but it makes
it
really good.
Is it The Bell Witch or something like that?
It's basically a story about a man whose wife dies, and then he falls in love with a 16-year-old girl. And the only way he can convince the dad of the 16-year-old girl to marry her is if the ghost of his wife came back. And so he well, it doesn't explain it, but basically the ghost of the wife comes back and fools hundreds of people. It becomes this huge media event in like the 1700s or whatever it was, 1600s. It's fascinating.
Oh, I'm
story.
Have to go for them.
This sounds familiar. It sounds that sounds kind of almost like the infamous scratching Fanny of Cock Lane story.
Oh, I don't know about that one, but it's only a few weeks old. That
you don't know about scratching Fanny.
Scratching Fanny of Cock Lane.
I mean, frankly, it sounds like a medical complaint, so I don't know. But yeah, if you ever get the chance to listen to that episode, it was only a few weeks ago.
Okay.
It's really good. It you get to the end, you go, huh, kind of like that.
For just over a couple of years, I've been doing my weird Bristol feed on Twitter and Instagram. And a couple of weeks ago, I decided that I was going to, I've started up kind of a sister feed to Bristol's sister city of Bath. Oh. So you can now follow strange stories from Bath history. And there was a lot of it there on at Weird Bath on Twitter and Instagram.
I did not know this because I live 7 miles from Bath. We call it Bath. It's one of those things around here where you go, how do you say the name of the city? And people either say Bath or Bath. And that you have to work out in the social situation which one you should say to make people trust you more. Oh, yes, I say Bath. A bit like scone and scone.
Yeah, I remember in Wisconsin, like when I was a few years back, I like stopping off in places called Bristol, and there was a Bristol in Wisconsin, and the town next door to it was called Bath, and I thought there must be a reference to it, and the actual sign had Bath written, and then like in brackets or parentheses, as they would say, B-A-R-T-H, because people do the, or Bath, because they do hard A's in America, and they'll say Beth.
Ah, cool. I would like to just plug the Lapis Paranormal Conference, which is happening in November. So it's happening from the 9th to the 10th of November, and I'm going to be speaking at it. I'm delivering a new talk called The Trials and Tribulations of a Real-Life Ghostbuster. And I'm going to be sharing some of the stories that I've never really shared before about the weird things that I've experienced and those that I've been able to explain and, you know, case closed. You can check out lapisparanormal.com. That's L-A-P-I-S paranormal.com. And that stands for the Lancashire Anomalous Phenomena Investigation Society, which is a mouthful and a half.
Yeah.
So this has been another episode of The Spooktator. Remember, you can find links to everything we have discussed at spooktator.co.uk, where you can also find links to our social media accounts too. We love to hear your thoughts, questions, comments and suggestions, so please do keep them coming. We'll be back soon with another episode, but until then, remember, spooky is in the eye of the beholder.